Hello, and welcome to a special Snow Day episode of the Abnormal Psychologist podcast. This is your host, Dr. Colby Taylor, and I'm recording this episode on a snow day. It's pretty rare in Memphis, Tennessee for us to get snow days. We might get one or two a year. And two nights ago, we ended up getting 5.25 inches of snow. I measured it very precisely. I think I've mentioned this in another episode, but I'm a huge weather nerd. I probably actually should have been a meteorologist instead of a psychologist. And actually going back and looking at like what I wanted to be when I grew up, you know, I wrote like a paper when I was in third grade or fourth grade. I always wanted to be a meteorologist, probably because I didn't know what a psychologist did. But anyways, I'd been tracking the system for like 2 weeks. I used pivotalweather.com to look at different weather models. And I look at them like 4 or 5 times a day. And my students always sort of enjoy me giving a brief weather forecast or whatever when I'm taking the role. And that'll actually come up later in today's episode. There's going to be some relevance to kind of my obsession about the weather to this episode. But anyways, lots of snow on the ground, and that's why I'm able to record an episode today, because my classes were canceled today. It was a snow day. And I was talking to my students last week in anticipation of the snow day, because again, I saw it coming. I actually gave them a certified forecast that was more accurate than what was on the television and everything. But I think snow days serve a mental health purpose. I know that different parts of the world don't get snow days, right? You don't get snow days if you grow up in an equatorial tropical climate. But in a place like Memphis, Tennessee, I think that a rare snow day is nice for mental health. And, you know, after the COVID-19 pandemic, there's so many different school districts. It's actually a hot button issue in front of a lot of school boards, whether to allow students to have snow days or if physical school is canceled to move class online. And so you'll read these articles. There was one in like U.S. Education Weekly or whatever a couple of weeks ago asking whether snow days are a thing of the past, because if you can't have physical school, you can just move things virtually. And, you know, as a developmental psychologist, I'm sort of the mindset that allowing kids a day or two of excitement when it snows to get out and, you know, have snowball fights, make snowmen, and not have to sit in front of an iPad or a computer for like 6 hours and probably get some poorly designed instruction where things aren't really sinking in. That's sort of beside the point. I think it's important to allow kids to have snow days, but that's just sort of my opinion. I do think it has some mental health benefits, and I'm not in favor of, you know, if you're snowed in for like 2 weeks, I get it. Instructional time is important. Maybe have some virtual school or whatever, but you know, the one-off or two-off snow days per year, let the kids enjoy them. But that's not the purpose of today's episode. We're not talking about snow days. Today, I thought we would talk about self-diagnosis. And this is a topic that my abnormal psychology class last year wanted to talk about a lot. What do I think about self-diagnosis? Do I think self-diagnosis is legitimate? And sort of when my students were introducing me to this conversation topic last semester, lots of them don't have health insurance. They're in their early 20s, they're American, and, you know, being able to get a diagnosis in a way is a privilege. And not many people have sort of the resources to be able to go out and get a diagnosis. So having a diagnosis in a way can be a privilege. That's point number one. And students oftentimes will say, I've been self-diagnosed with a condition, but I've never been formally diagnosed with a condition. And does self-diagnosis carry any weight? And what does that mean? So I thought we would explore the topic of self-diagnosis in today's episode. And it's something that's sort of been on my mind a little bit too. And I'll get back to sort of that meteorology bit that I mentioned would become more relevant towards the end of the episode. All right. Anyway, self-diagnosis. And, you know, I did an episode on diagnosis back in, I think it was 2022, May of 2022. And the title of the episode was Dueling Diagnoses. And I mentioned that there's no real diagnosis that's out there. There's no book of like, you're certified and you're diagnosed with this. I mean, we have the DSM-5 text revision. We have insurance companies that might keep, you know, diagnostic codes of what you're diagnosed with. But the reality is there's no like card carrying member that I am diagnosed with this, and this is the real diagnosis and whatever. And you can go to lots of different mental health professionals and you'll get disparity in diagnosis. They won't be on the same page. And I sort of mentioned in that episode, I think, will the real diagnosis please stand up? You might be diagnosed by one professional with ADHD. Another professional might say there's no problem. And a third professional might diagnose you with like autism spectrum disorder. And you're like, do I have autism and ADHD? Is it one or the other? You know, it can be very confusing. Confusing even for mental health professionals. So there is no like real diagnosis gold standard book of what you're diagnosed with that's out there. So when I'm asked, is self-diagnosis legitimate? If it's legitimate to you, then I guess it is legitimate because who am I to sort of say something's legitimate or not? So we're already starting to see some pros and cons of self-diagnosis. So a pro that I mentioned earlier is there's a lot of people that don't have health insurance. They might not have access to a mental health care professional. Maybe they live in a rural area and there's no mental health care professional that's nearby. So we're already seeing some pros that are there. Also, there's a lot of knowledge that's at your fingertips. You're listening to this podcast right now. No time in human history have you had this much knowledge of mental health at your disposal, right? You can get on Google. You can access like PubMed and read articles. You can have as much information as just about anybody that's out there on a particular condition. You're also the expert in yourself. So nobody knows more about yourself than you. So again, who am I to sort of judge if you've gone and done all of this research on a certain, you know, some sort of condition and you know more about yourself than I could ever glean in a 30-minute intake session with you, then I would say that you might have the information to make a diagnosis on yourself. That's a pro for self-diagnosis. Also, if you go and see a mental health care practitioner, so let's say that you're fortunate and privileged enough to go see a psychologist, in their diagnostic detective work, they're probably going to rely a lot on what you have to say about the condition anyway. Especially if you're presenting with an internalizing problem. So you're presenting with something like anxiety or depression that might not be apparent on the surface. It might be sort of an invisible psychopathology. They're going to rely a lot on what we call self-rating scales to determine their diagnosis. So you're basically going to see somebody, you're paying a copay or paying out of pocket to see a practitioner, and you're filling out some sort of questionnaire for you to diagnose yourself in the presence of a mental health care practitioner. That's a lot of times how it is for something like anxiety, depression, or even something like ADHD. Lots of times we rely on behavioral rating scales, and as part of that, you'll rate yourself on distractibility and inattention and that sort of thing. So more often than not, if you go and see a mental health care practitioner and they give you a self-rating scale, something like the Beck Depression Inventory or something like that, and you say you have depression, you're going to walk away with a depression diagnosis. So a lot of times you're essentially doing self-diagnosis, but you're paying for it in the presence of a mental health care practitioner. There is some research on like diagnostic accuracy and comparing a person sort of rating themselves and a third person, like a mental health care practitioner. So ratings of you and, you know, how often are they on the same page? Is there sort of inter-rater agreement between the two? And most research says that there's a lot of overlap, that there's a lot of inter-rater agreement between two people. So a lot of times self-diagnosis is on the same page as what a mental health care practitioner would diagnose you with. So we do see a lot of inter-rater agreement. There is some research that suggests that people rate themselves as more severe a lot of times than mental health professionals, especially in relationship to those internalizing problems. So again, your psychologist might not see your insomnia. They might not see sort of your subjective distress, that you're up at 1 a.m. you can report it to them, but they don't see your heart rate at 1 a.m. When you're panicking about something. And can't go back to sleep till 3 a.m. it's really hard to sort of express emotions and remember emotions. A lot of times I'll talk to folks that say they go and see a psychologist or they go and see a counselor. And, you know, they have their 30-minute session or they have their hour session. And there's so much that they forgot to mention to their therapist in that session. They just kind of want to kick themselves. They sort of get like deer in the headlights a lot of times, especially if you have some social anxiety. And you can't really remember everything that you're going to tell the therapist. And for like the next week, you just think about everything that you should have told them. And so maybe you didn't think about the 2 hours that you're up in the middle of the night and that didn't come up in session. It's something that is salient to you and that you can remember. So again, another point for maybe self-diagnosis. But it is interesting that people tend to rate themselves as more severe than mental health professionals. Maybe a con of self-diagnosis is, I'm going to label this insight-driven diagnosis. So there's certain conditions where you have insight into having the condition. Anxiety. A lot of times you have very visceral insight into your own anxiety. You know when you feel nervous. You know sort of your physiological arousal to events, like your heart rate going up, you sweating, you becoming flush in the skin when you're anxious. But there are other disorders that everybody around you might see, but you don't have insight into. So we might talk about something like a substance use disorder, where you don't think you have a problem, but your significant other and your family members and your coworkers all see that problem. And self-diagnosis, you know, might not be the best situation in that case, because you might say, I don't have any sort of problem, but everybody else around you sees it. And if you went to a psychologist or a mental health care professional, they might see it too. So self-diagnosis doesn't work for everything. It might be better for those internalizing, insight-driven diagnoses and not necessarily ones that you don't have very good insight into. I know that, and this might be really controversial among other psychologists. We're sort of like a guild, like a medieval guild, where we want to be able to look after our own turf and protect our own employability. We've worked really hard, if you're a psychologist or psychiatrist, to get to where you're at, right? You've done a ton of training. You've done 4 years undergrad, probably 5 years graduate school, a year postdoc. So you probably have at least 10 years invested into your own education. And you want that to mean something. You don't want it to be that somebody can just come in with sort of PubMed articles and your Google search that I talked about earlier, and arrive at the same conclusion that you do. You want to be able to have your stamp of approval in it for it to sort of mean something on a diagnosis. And so I don't want to really discount all of the education that people have, that mental health care professionals have, because it is really important. But it's probably not so important in a majority of cases. I think with a pretty rudimentary understanding of mental health, and being able to navigate resources that are at your disposal, plus a healthy case of introspection, that you will probably arrive 80, 85% of the time at the same conclusion that a mental health care professional would arrive at too. But I think that our stamp of approval is especially important for that 15% of time, and that there is still a role of psychologists and psychiatrists in sort of legitimizing and that can be kind of dangerous, saying legitimizing, because that means that some conditions aren't necessarily legitimate. And that rubs people the wrong way when psychologists don't come to the same conclusion that a person has. And I've done that a couple of times, especially working with parents. They think their child has a certain condition. And I've worked with them a few times. I bring in other professionals, and we just don't see it. And we do have to serve as gatekeepers in a way. And so I think that gatekeeper role to certain diagnoses and to certain treatments is still really, really important, because we don't want people to abuse the system. And again, a lot of times with insurance companies, right, they're approving very expensive, like it or not, a lot of these treatments and therapies are expensive, a lot of expensive therapies, and we need to be able to serve as gatekeepers in a way, what have you. Closely related to this, and this could probably turn into its own episode, is using artificial intelligence for diagnosis, AI. Can something like ChatGPT be able to diagnose you accurately with a certain mental health care condition. It's something that could be free, very accessible. Lots of people have AI at their fingertips. And could this be the future of mental health, where you sort of talk to some sort of chatbot, you input your symptoms, and it comes up with a diagnosis? I'm really intrigued by this idea. There is some research that shows that AI is pretty accurate at coming to diagnostic conclusions, or, you know, it's hard to say what's accurate, what's not, but at least it comes to agreement. I guess we're talking about it's kind of reliable when comparing it to what mental health, like inter-rater agreement with what a real live person with education and expertise in psychology would come up with. There is agreement a lot of times between AI and that. And, you know, I think a lot of it comes from sort of the formulaic, a lot of that agreement comes from the formulaic way in which the DSM-5 is written. That, you know, a chatbot can check certain boxes and see if you meet diagnostic criteria for a condition. And it might even be less prone to error than people, because it's built into sort of its programming to know minimum symptom duration. You know, it's not going to have the human error of somebody trying to remember what's in the DSM-5 for, you know, the minimum 6 months that you need for most anxiety disorders. AI has that down. And it's going to be able to sort of ask you the right questions to be able to check the boxes that you meet those symptoms. So I am intrigued by AI. I've been intrigued by AI since I was in graduate school, like 10 years ago. I thought that AI might be able to do a good job of intelligence testing. There's a lot of human error, and one of my friends did their dissertation on human error in intelligence testing and trying to get an IQ. So intelligence testing usually takes place in a sort of one-to-one setting where you have the tester and you have somebody that's trying to get their IQ assessed. And there's so many places that error can come in along the way in IQ testing. It could be simple mathematic errors by the tester, where they're trying to add how many scores you have correct and they forget to carry a one or something and they arrive to the wrong conclusion. It could be administering the test wrong. They don't read things off in a standardized way. So there's a lot of different places that testing can go wrong, and there's a lot of different sources of error in intelligence testing. And what better way to standardize something, and this sounds sort of dystopian, but then to digitize it, to have sort of AI administer it. And speaking of with ADHD testing, you know, you can have a psychologist that's sitting there and looking for signs of hyperactivity, like how many times you fidget. They can, you know, look and see if your foot's bouncing up and down, or how many times you play with your hair, whatever your hyperactive behaviors are. And they might be able to, you know, do a tally mark and come up with a count and say, you're more hyperactive than X percent of the population. But computers with cameras and with sensors can do this very scarily accurately, right? So at the University of Memphis, I think they used to have this thing called like a butt chair that cognitive psychologists would use. And based on like how you're sitting, there'd be a lot of different haptic sensors in a chair cushion. And the computer could tell how well you're paying attention by, like, most people, when they're, you know, rapt in attention and really interested in something, they lean forward in the chair. And based on sort of the placement of your weight in the chair, it could give a pretty good indicator of whether you're paying attention or not. Also, we have webcam technology that can track your eyes, right? And can see if you're paying attention. Maybe if you're scanning text, if you're looking at text and reading text from a screen, we can see whether your eyes are scanning every single line of text. And when you combine that with something like a butt chair, you're getting very good indicators of attention that you wouldn't necessarily be able to get from John Q. psychologist that's sitting there with his clipboard or her clipboard looking at every fidget or twitch that you're making. So I do think that there's a place for AI in diagnosis, especially in diagnosis. So that sort of leads to, what about AI with therapy? And I've seen that there are certain chatbots that have been sort of busted open, jailbroken in a way. Lots of chatbot companies have put restrictions on like their chatbots being able to do therapy because that can leave you open to lawsuits. But there have been people that have been able to jailbreak chatbots and have them deliver therapy. And this is maybe important if it's, you know, 11:30 p.m. at night, your psychologist is not available. Maybe you're feeling acutely depressed, possibly even suicidal. We do have, you know, suicide hotlines. I did an episode on that about a year and a half ago. But you could sit down at your computer, talk to the chatbot, and instantaneously maybe get therapeutic advice. So that's kind of nice that you could have a therapist at your fingertips that might be able to learn and memorize your condition and sort of your idiosyncrasies better than, you know, John Q therapist. It's a person might be able to do. So I'm intrigued by AI therapy. I think it still has a long way to go. I think there needs to be a lot better effectiveness research on AI therapy. Is there something to, and I think there is, to building rapport with another person and sort of the interpersonal aspect of therapy, I think is really important, especially in treating a lot of different conditions. But I am intrigued by AI therapy. I have read some horror stories about AI therapy going wrong. I think there was a case in the Netherlands where there was a man that was acutely suicidal, and he asked the chat box, he told the chat box, disclosed to the chat box that he was feeling suicidal and asked, you know, what can I do about it? And the chat box actually encouraged him to commit suicide. And then he completed suicide, and I believe now his widow is suing the chatbot company. So, there are definitely ways that AI therapy can go wrong. I promised I would link this back to sort of my obsession with meteorology early in childhood. I've sort of been on the fence about whether I have autism spectrum disorder or not, whether I have Asperger's. And Asperger's doesn't exist anymore, but like a high-functioning form of autism. I know that when I was little, I was... I had some sensory sensitivity. I didn't like certain loud noises, which is evolutionarily, it makes sense in a lot of ways. But I think I mentioned in a previous episode, I didn't like loud toilet flushers. And I also had certain sort of restricted interest, one of which was the weather. I was really into the weather when I was 5 or 6 years old, and I'm still really into the weather today. The American Civil War was another restricted interest. And I was doing like genealogy when I was like 6 or 7 years old. So I had sort of the criteria B for autism, and as maybe an expert in autism, and maybe this is med school syndrome sort of coming in, med student syndrome, where you think you have every condition that you study. But the more like I come to understand about autism, my wife is like, yeah, I think you actually check a lot of the boxes for autism. And the reason this is kind of coming up now is my 2-year-old son shows a lot of the same sensory sensitivity and stuff that I showed when I was little. But I'm curious your thoughts. I also think that there is a danger to self-diagnosis, especially if something like autism. You read stories about celebrities that are like, I self-diagnosed myself with autism when I was 30 years old. And I think that a lot of times you haven't had to deal with the stigma and the hardships that a lot of people with autism might have had. I kind of compare it to saying that, like, I know here in the American South, people say they're X percent Cherokee. A lot of people are like, oh, yeah, I have Native American ancestry. That's sort of insulting to somebody with legitimate Native American ancestry in that you did not, you know, if you're 2% Cherokee or whatever, you probably didn't experience the discrimination of, you know, folks that grew up in Cherokee Nation, if that makes any sense. So I think there might be some danger with self-diagnosis there, but I'm curious your thoughts. Should I like pursue a diagnosis in autism? I mean, that's essentially what I do is diagnose children, but, interesting question. Speaking of sort of interesting questions, we do have a mailbag question that has to do with diagnosis. So the mailbag question says, I'm a longtime listener to your podcast. I started listening sometime around 2021, and I've been meaning to write you for quite some time, but it never seemed to be the right time. I hope you know how much all of your listeners appreciate your work and the work you put into this podcast. And I always learn new things. That makes me feel really good. That's part of the reason why I'm still trying to pump out episodes. I, unlike many of your listeners that write in, am not part of the psych field, but I have struggled with mental illness for much of my life and have always been very interested in the realm of psychology. I was wondering if you had any insight into receiving a diagnosis at a very young age that doesn't seem to fit now that you're an adult. For instance, I received a cluster B personality disorder diagnosis at age 16, and was later diagnosed with bipolar disorder, although both are considered current diagnoses. Are there recommended ages for accurate diagnosis specifically for personality disorders? In addition, I was curious if challenging a diagnosis that was received as an adolescent is something you've seen in your practice. Thank you. This is signed the letter C. So this is a great question, really a great series of questions. So I'm going to try to unpack this a little bit. First off, let's talk about whether personality disorders, is there any sort of age restriction? And we can go to the DSM-5 text revision. And on page 736 and 737 of the DSM-5 TR, we have personality disorder categories may be applied with children or adolescents in those relatively unusual instances in which the individual's particular maladaptive personality traits appear to be pervasive, persistent, and unlikely to be limited to a particular developmental stage or attributable to another mental disorder. It should be recognized that the traits of personality disorder that appear in childhood will often not persist unchanged into adult life. For a personality disorder to be diagnosed in an individual younger than 18 years, the features must have been present for at least 1 year. And the one exception to this is antisocial personality disorder, which cannot be diagnosed in individuals younger than 18 years. Okay, so it is possible to diagnose a child or adolescent with a personality disorder, but it's essentially discouraged, except in very exceptional circumstances where you think there's no way that they're going to outgrow this, and this is essentially ingrained in them as part of their personality. And that's, a lot of times people don't like diagnosing with borderline personality disorder prior to 16, and a lot of times not prior to 18 or 19, because, you know, we talk about borderline personality disorder as being a disorder of instability in emotions, instability in behaviors, instability in cognition. And by definition, adolescents are unstable. And we want to make sure this is not just a stage that you're going through in development, that this is something that's going to persist into adulthood. So I think that might get at the first part of your question. You might have just heard my email beeping or ringing. I think that is saying that, let me check. School is canceled tomorrow and Friday. So I get two snow days in a row. That was my Outlook telling me that I get two more snow days. Hooray, I guess. I'm starting to get cabin fever. Maybe I can do an episode on cabin fever a little bit. But let me get back to C's mailbag. She asked if I had any experience with this. And most of the experience I have is actually in the opposite direction. So she mentioned she was diagnosed first with borderline personality disorder and then now realizes that she has bipolar disorder or both. You can have both. And that might be why both are considered current diagnoses right now. Usually I see the opposite. I have a lot of students that take my course and they didn't know that much about borderline personality disorder or bipolar disorder, especially a lot of female students that might have been diagnosed when they were like 10, 11, 12, 13 years old with a bipolar disorder. They take my course and we start talking about manic and hypomanic episodes and they're like, this doesn't describe me at all. I've never experienced a manic episode. I've never experienced a hypomanic episode before. And they were diagnosed with a bipolar disorder, again, as an adolescent. And unfortunately, I see this a lot in that if you go to maybe a psychiatric inpatient facility, it's a lot easier to diagnose bipolar disorder because it's more medicable. It's easier to give medication for. And I think that a lot of psychiatrists, not a lot of psychiatrists, but there are psychiatrists that are quick to pull the trigger on bipolar disorder in order to be able to prescribe a mood stabilizer. And then, you know, these individuals might reach 18, 19, 20, and they're like, I've never experienced a manic episode before. Bipolar doesn't seem to fit. So I usually see the opposite direction. Diagnosed with bipolar and then realize that they have borderline personality disorder and not bipolar later in life. That is a tough differential diagnosis to make between bipolar and borderline, because there's a lot of overlap that's there. And I was doing, so I was looking at some research papers prior to this episode. And if you have a clinician that's overly focused on assessing instability and impulsivity, then they're more likely to confound borderline personality disorder with bipolar disorder, because both are characterized by instability and impulsivity. So we need to look deeper than impulsivity and instability to determine which disorder, or whether you have both disorder, which disorder you actually have. There is research that indicates that assessments or screeners that look at fears of abandonment tend to be better able to distinguish between borderline personality disorder and bipolar disorder, in that the more fears of abandonment you're expressing, the more indicative that you have borderline personality disorder. Another thing that we should look at is, again, the presence of like a true manic episode or hypomanic episode. So looking at sleep, I think, is really important. A lot of times you don't have sleep disturbance with borderline that you would have with bipolar. So looking at sleep and then looking at that genetic component. If you have a first order family member that has bipolar disorder, you're having some sleep disturbances and you're also having sort of that impulsivity and instability, I'd be more likely to lean towards bipolar than I would borderline. So tough differential to make. I think I covered most of this email. I think she mentioned challenging a diagnosis. Is there a way to like appeal this? And I think it might depend on where you live and, you know, how involved insurance and managed care is to your situation. Going back to earlier in this episode, there's like no like card carrying, you have this diagnosis or you don't, pathognomonic place where your true diagnosis exists outside of maybe insurance companies. So if you want to challenge a diagnosis, I think your best two courses of action would be talk to your insurance company and say you feel like a certain diagnosis is no longer accurate, and ask them what you can do. Can you get a second or third opinion on that? And then also going to see another mental health care practitioner and seeing if they arrive at a different diagnostic conclusion than whoever you saw prior to the age of 16. So great mailbag question. Please send me more mailbag questions. I think I have one or two more that I might be able to cover in a future episode. I have one or two that are sitting in my inbox right now, right behind the school is canceled email that I received like 5 minutes ago. But send them to CTAYLO41@CBU.edu. Put in the subject line mailbag and I'll try to get to it. I'm going to go enjoy the rest of my snow day. So hopefully y'all are staying warm wherever you are. I guess if you're in the southern hemisphere, I know we have some listeners in Australia. I hope you're staying cool. And until the next episode, take care and stay well.